This is an AMI podcast. This is an AMI podcast.
I'm Dave Brown, and this is a podcast version of AMI's Morning Show, Now with Dave Brown. Catch the live broadcasts weekdays from 9 to 11 a.m. Eastern on AMI Audio and AMI TV. Welcome back. It's Now with Dave Brown on AMI. It is news panel time. Let's bring back into the show Joita Gupta and Michelle McQuigg. Hey, good morning, Joita.
Good morning, Dave.
And good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Dave.
Let's jump right into our first story, guys. The federal government has frozen Hockey Canada's funding, effective immediately. Minister of Sport Pascal Saint-Ange made the announcement in response to the organization's handling of a sexual assault scandal and settlement. Saint-Ange said Hockey Canada will only have funding restored once it discloses recommendations contained in an incomplete report by a third-party law firm hired to investigate an alleged group sex incident. Hockey Canada must also become a signatory to the Officer of the Integrity Commissioner, a new government agency with the power to independently investigate abuse complaints and levy sanctions. And just a little more context, this stems from several members of the unnamed members of the 2018 World Junior squad who engaged in non-consensual group sex in a hotel room after a Hockey Canada golf tournament one summer. Joita, this is your topic. Why did you want us to go a little bit deeper?
I think it's a topic that's been making waves and has been just about in every major publication in the last week. I feel like it really has been a story that has churned to the surface many of the systemic issues that plague professional hockey, the culture of masculinity, and whether the many efforts made over the decades to address sexual assault in hockey have actually come to fruition. And of course, you've got the federal government there now, deciding to freeze their funding to Hockey Canada. What is the impact of that going to be? Is it really going to make a difference? And, you know, could Hockey Canada do more to deal with situations like this when and if they come up? Are you happy with the way that this was handled? Are you dissatisfied with how it went? There's so many interesting questions to talk about, but all of this is happening in the backdrop of many concerned voices where people are saying, look, no one's really surprised or shocked that something like this has gone down. We have to address some of the systemic problems that plague professional hockey. So what is the way forward? I think that is the ultimate question.
The choice to go right after the money and freeze that funding makes sense to me, especially with the strings attached. Michelle, what do you think?
I agree, although I question aspects of the impact of the financial freeze specifically, although I think ultimately it will all come down to the same thing. So one thing that's really jumped out at me through all this is how much money Hockey Canada has. They got $14 million worth of federal funding, some documents have shown, and that is about sixth in terms of their revenue streams. They get a whole lot more from partnerships and advertising and a whole lot of other stuff, which doesn't stand to be affected by this. But I do think that freezing the funding and forcing them to sign on to things like the Office of the Integrity Commissioner and some of the other mechanisms that are in place here, to say nothing of all the publicity that Joita mentioned, I think that's where the impact will really be felt. Obviously, $14 million is not small change, even if it is sixth in their revenue stream. But this has really been shining a light on this and forcing some scrutiny and forcing more active conversation. And I think that's where the real benefit will be. This is a situation that has lots of tendrils. This happened at the World Juniors, of course, or with the World Junior team from some years ago, but some of those players are now in the NHL. Even though we don't know who they are, we know that much. So this is an issue that has extreme reach, extreme impact, is close to the heart of a lot of Canadians, and I think by forcing it into the limelight like this, on top of the financial penalties, I think that's where the benefit of the government's actions will really come through.
Michelle, I'm glad you mentioned the financial streams that exist there, the $14 million only being sixth in the amount of money they received. Hockey Canada took a lot of COVID funding from the federal government as well. So if we can say that the money doesn't really affect them, then why were they taking all that COVID funding? But that could be a totally different issue about who was getting some of this money in this economic recovery. And I don't want to dismiss the importance of this topic. Joita, what do you make of the decision from the federal government?
I think in a lot of ways the federal government had to do something. When the story broke on TSN, it would have been deeply problematic for the federal government to have done nothing. And so even though the financial impact of freezing the funds may not be felt by Hockey Canada to the same extent as, you know, some other institutions or agencies. It's still making a statement. The fact that Hockey Canada has been required to make public the recommendations of the report, as yet unpublished, that's going to be a really important step forward as well. I think by withholding by freezing their funding, it is a way to ensure that those recommendations at minimum see the light of day. And the fact that they might be asked to sign on with the Office of the Integrity Commissioner means that at least in future, there may be some kind of an accountability mechanism. But I agree with Michelle. I think the real impact here is that this has become a widely publicized public issue. I think the reputational damage to Hockey Canada may far exceed any financial penalty. And yet there is, in some respects, more that the federal government could do, and maybe we'll see some announcements about this down the road. For example, I know there are people who sort of scoff at, oh, not another public inquiry. But, you know, given that there are many voices who have said this is a longstanding systemic issue, maybe the federal government could think about calling a public inquiry, not just to look at this incident, but sort of some of the broader structural and systemic issues that might facilitate abuse and predation and violence against women in hockey. And what a public inquiry allows you to do is subpoena things and really go deep into the issues. Whether, you know, you'll actually see recommendations from the public inquiry further implemented, well, now we're just speculating. But that is something that the federal government could do down the road. Unfortunately, in this situation, because the incident took place in Ontario, they couldn't, for example, get the RCMP involved, nor could they lay criminal charges. So there are also a lot of things that they couldn't do under the circumstances. Really, they've done the bare minimum that they could. The financial penalties, I think, was almost expected, because it's not like the federal government in the situation could have really gotten away with doing nothing, especially when questions are surfacing about whether public dollars were used to settle the lawsuit with the woman. She asked for $3.55 million, but we don't know what the settlement amount actually was, and there's a non-disclosure agreement that she had to sign. So again, there are questions swirling about whether, you know, tax dollars went into paying off this woman as well.
It was particularly embarrassing when Hockey Canada's top brass was testifying this week in front of federal politicians and really didn't have their facts in a row. The investigation is incomplete. Only six players participated in the voluntary investigation that went on here. Six of 24 players, by the way. The facts weren't straight. The investigation was woeful. Michelle, what do you think they could have done better? I mean, I would say right away, you have to make testifications or this investigation compulsory. You must participate if you were part of this team or at this tournament.
I mean, that's certainly something I would want to see as well. I should clarify that, yeah, we heard the number six initially, which was jaw-dropping, and then later on, but this kind of speaks to your point as well, some of the Hockey Canada officials later said, oh, sorry, our bad, it was more like 13, which is still only about half of the number of people that were there.
But 13 when they weren't under oath. It was 13 to the media. It was six when they were under oath.
Fair enough. Yeah. No, I mean, and this is part of it, right? Like we there were no clear answers. That was the justification, or part of the justification that Saint-Ange used when she decided to freeze his funding, is the fact that answers were not forthcoming. Yeah, mandatory testimony, I think, is going to be important, although it might be difficult to pull off just in light. I'm thinking of, you know, mechanisms in place for things like the Special Investigations Unit for police and investigating police complaints. A lot of that stuff is not mandatory either. So maybe there are rules in place that would hamper that effort, but I do think there would be a whole lot more onus on players to cooperate and be forthcoming. Some internal process would be necessary, but one complicating factor here is that they did enlist a third-party outfit to conduct this investigation. Maybe you need to have better rules on who can conduct that and how those are conducted. Obviously, an internal process would not calm any waves here. Disclosing documentation, disclosing results of the investigation, I think would be a big one. That's another one where we don't have a lot of answers. We don't even know how much a settlement was for at this point. So increasing transparency all around, I think, would start to address some of these concerns.
Yeah.
Start.
In the end, you may not be able to find a resolution in this particular case because the settlement's already been reached. But this is an example. This could set an example and a template for what you want to do moving forward, or what should be done moving forward.
Exactly. And it's worth pointing out that they've indicated they had three such cases before them in the recent years. Mm-hmm. We've only really heard about the one. So obviously, this is a systemic issue that needs to be addressed more broadly.
Joita, what do you think could be done to make for a better investigative process if Hockey Canada does not want to sign on to these federal regulations or federal restrictions or federal strings?
Well, the first thing that I would say is that this really should have been a criminal matter, and it should have been dealt with through the criminal courts. Unfortunately, and this is not surprising, the victim in this case chose not to go to the police and did not want to go through the legal process. I know I've said this before, and others have made the point as well, that the legal system can often feel like a second rape for women. So there's a bigger issue there about why matters that rightly ought to be dealt with through the criminal process do not get dealt with in that way. I think I was reading a column in the Globe and Mail yesterday by Greg Mason, who basically called the whole thing a cover-up, that the whole thing smells of a cover-up, where the whole impetus behind this investigation and the desire to keep things under wraps and keep things secretive was to protect the reputation of Hockey Canada, to protect the reputation of the sports, and most importantly, to protect the privacy and reputation of the players and to make sure that their careers weren't jeopardized in any way. Because that report, which was conducted by, as Michelle mentioned, a third-party law firm, which is headed up by Marie Hanin, who you might recognize was Gian Gomeshi's lawyer, not that that means anything, that report is still to be made public. None of the names have been made public, so we don't actually know who was in the room. There's no way to hold anybody accountable. And just out of idle curiosity, I was going over the list of the 2018 World Junior Hockey Team to see if were all of these fellows under the age of 18, because that would sort of justify a ban on their names. But no, they're all, as far as I can see, most of them were 20. There was a 19-year-old. Certainly when the incident took place, most of them appear to have been over the age of 18. So it really is baffling to me why nobody's names were made public. Moreover, I do agree about the point, about the fact that these, the decision to cooperate with the committee was entirely voluntary, which is really surprising. Now, mind you, I haven't played professional hockey. Maybe the two of you have, but the little bit I know.
I was this close, Joita. I was this close.
You're hilarious, yeah. Truly.
But you know what? The little I've gathered from secondhand knowledge is that everything to do with professional hockey of any kind is highly regimented. What you eat in the morning, the uniform you wear, the pads that you use, the number of push-ups you do—all of those things are mandatory. Why is it that every aspect of this game and training for the game is mandatory except participating on a really important committee? So that's, again, a really baffling, and it kind of ties back to that the point that I was making about how the investigation process really appears to have been more of an effort to cover up rather than a genuine attempt to try and get to the bottom of what happened here.
This story, unfortunately, is not uncommon. It comes on the heels of the Kyle Beach, Chicago Blackhawks, sexual assault situation that became publicly also reported by TSN's Rick Westhead in the fall of last year. I think we talked about that story on this news panel. We've talked about the USA Gymnastics scandal on this panel. I've spoken extensively about violence against women in relation to the NFL, Ben Roethlisberger, Ray Rice, even right now, Deshaun Watson of the Cleveland Browns continuing to be in the headlines, with 24 civil suits for alleged sexual misconduct, and the New York Times reporting at least 40 more cases that are unsettled, including some in the building of the Houston Texans. There are structural issues that exist inside professional and amateur sports when it comes to sexual assault. Michelle, does this story suggest anything different to you about where we're at despite the conversations that we've had for the last decade or so?
Not as much as we'd like to see, but I am a little bit heartened, I think, by the amount of scrutiny and discussion that it's received. Yes, it continues the trend we've just talked about. Having these conversations is no longer new, but now we are starting to see some action attached to this. I can't honestly imagine the federal government yanking funding 10 years ago. Now that's happened. I think it's a matter of starting to set some new precedents, and if they get Hockey Canada signed up to some of these other mechanisms that were ostensibly anyway supposed to offer some additional safeguards, I think that can only be progress. I think what's emerging here in Canada specifically is a growing complexity around the picture involving violence and toxicity in amateur sport. Boxing Canada has another really interesting scandal going on too. I won't get into it all now, but that's another one where workplace culture is really being attacked on a pretty direct level with some pretty strong accusations. So it is interesting to me to see that we are, I think we're starting to move past the conversation point. Obviously, there's a whole lot more that needs to be done. But the very fact that some actions are being taken, even if I think we've all reached a consensus that perhaps not enough, but the fact that this new phase has begun, I think, is an encouraging sign. That's about as far as I'll go.
Juita, along those lines, even though we've had certainly some strong conversations over the course of the last decade, we're still seeing these incidents. Where does it leave the overall picture and landscape of sexual misconduct in sports?
Well, speaking specifically that, you know, just if you look at some of the comments made by Sheldon Kennedy, for example, at least as far as hockey is concerned, Sheldon Kennedy says that not very much has changed over the decades. And that's a really powerful thing to say, because there is a culture in, at least in junior hockey, for example, where, you know, kids are taken away, teenagers are taken away from their parents, they live with billeted families, they get a lot of social power. It's a sort of an alcohol-fueled culture. And there is this whole culture of sexualized hazing. I don't know if all of that has really undergone significant change. And the reason I say it hasn't, it doesn't feel like it's undergone significant change, is because, and I wish I could remember where I read this, but someone really broke it down extremely well. And they said, you know, the way that the woman was there was one player who bought her several drinks. He then took her to his room. She left with one person, but then he invited his friends to join. And that's not just an accident. That was a strategy. And later on, they made her take a video in which she claimed that she was sober. And that's not just, you know, a random act. That's alibi creation. Yeah. Then they made her take a shower on her way out. And that's a way to reduce the amount of available evidence for a rape kit. And that's predation. And so what the point that was being made is that this has happened, this isn't a one-off, this has happened before. And unless something really changes, it may, I am sad to say, happen again. And so you don't just need high level conversations. You need conversations at the grassroots. There's a lot of young men who entertain dreams of playing in the NHL. Hockey has a really special place in the hearts of many Canadians. And there are hundreds of thousands of young Canadians who get involved in some kind of organized sports across this country. This issue requires far more attention than it's been getting. I feel like we've been going in circles, having the same conversation over and over again. Whether we've reached a tipping point or whether we've truly turned a corner, I am not convinced that enough has been done in this instance. There is so much that is unknown in this particular instance, and the federal government's moves, although welcome, are frankly pro forma. So I am waiting to see what changes and whether we would be in the truly unfortunate situation 3 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line, where we end up inevitably having the same conversation all over again.
The one thing that hockey could take a lesson from is the world of basketball, where women are becoming way more prevalent, not just at the elite level of the sport, but all throughout the sport in regard to coaching young men. It showed last night in the NBA draft, two of the guys taken in the top five were the sons of high-level women's basketball coaches. We're seeing a much stronger integration of women into the coaching structures and managerial structures of that sport at the grassroots and elite levels. It makes a big difference. We have not seen that in hockey. We're starting to see it a little bit with NHL teams bringing in top-level female coaches and development coaches, but it's not happening at the grassroots, and that's something that hockey should be taking a very close look at the way that basketball is seeing this, because frankly, we just don't see these kinds of stories out of the basketball world. Okay, that's it. We have
great
to move
point.
On. You've been listening to Now with Dave Brown. Hit the subscribe button on any podcast platform and leave us a rating and a review.
This was an AMI podcast. For more accessible media, visit AMI.ca.